Funds for the California Report are provided by the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians, on the web at chcf.org. And URS, a global engineering and construction firm working to improve California's public infrastructure, preserve the state's natural resources, and strengthen the environment. URS.com.
This is the California Report. I'm Rachel Miro in for Scott Schaefer. Coming up, the San Onofre Nuclear Power Plant is closing permanently. We'll talk with a reporter from San Diego about why the decision was made and what it means for the state's power supply. Plus, immigration reform is a personal story for every family affected. We'll check in with one family granted amnesty during the Reagan administration.
Mom and Dad, once they had amnesty, they had that confidence that nothing was going to, you know, stop them from achieving all their dreams.
Also, a new play challenges us to reassess what we think about the comments people post online.
I guess they're necessary.
Mixed blessing.
It's what people think, but they're too afraid to say.
It's the California Report. We begin today with the news Southern California Edison has decided to shut down its San Onofre nuclear power plant permanently. The announcement generated immediate comment from Governor Jerry Brown and both U.S. senators. Here's Senator Barbara Boxer.
I knew that this plant was not safe and that it was not safe to reopen. And we've got 8 million people living within 50 miles of that plant.
We turn now to Allison St. John of KPBS in San Diego, who's been following the drama surrounding the plant ever since it first shut down a year and a half ago. Allison, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Remind us why the plant was closed in the first place.
So back in January of last year, the company, Southern California Edison, closed both units after what was characterized at the time as a small radiation leak emanating from one of their steam generators. The steam generators had just been replaced. One of them had been running for about a year, one of them less than a year. And so basically the investigations into what went wrong suggest that those steam generators were based on a faulty computer model and are not safe to run.
What is the utility saying about why they decided to shut down this plant?
Well, they had hoped to restart one of the units, Unit 2, at 70% power, and they had an application into the Nuclear Regulatory Commission asking for the permission to start it again this month, actually, to meet peak demand. But the NRC has recently handed over a question to one of their arms called the Atomic Safety Licensing Board, which was a petition from a group called Friends of the Earth that said, the public really needs to have a full public hearing on these new steam generators before they get started up again. And the Atomic Safety Licensing Board agreed with them. So this promised a much longer process than Edison had hoped for. And they say that their cost-benefit analysis suggests that waiting till possibly late next year makes it not cost-effective anymore to keep the plant open. They're cutting their losses, and they've decided to shut down both units.
What do we do with a plant sitting on the beach there in San Onofre?
Well, the fuel will have to ultimately remain on site. And the company said it has enough stainless steel dry casks to store all of it on site until the federal government makes a decision on what to do with spent nuclear fuel nationwide. That could be years and years. The decommissioning altogether is obviously one of the most expensive aspects of nuclear power. And there is a fund which has so far collected $2.7 billion. Apparently, that is about 90% of what they estimate they will need to fully decommission the plant.
San Onofre is a big plant. It used to supply 18% of Southern California's power. Now what?
Well, the people who are responsible for keeping the lights on in California, that's the CAISO, Independent Systems Operator, have been looking into alternative sources of power. And they say that basically California is looking pretty good, the state as a whole. It has 19% reserves for this year, which is more than what they would like to see, 15% reserves. However, they do say that Southern California is in a position of a little bit of vulnerability. It should make it through the summer months, the peak demand of the summer months, as long as there are not any unforeseen circumstances, such as wildfires. Then the California Public Utilities Commission, the Energy Division Director there, Ed Randolph, is also pretty confident that we'll be okay for the coming months at least. Here's what he has to say.
We had already been planning for this plant not to be operating this summer. We believe in all but the most extreme events that there's still sufficient power in Southern California, provided when we call for conservation, the conservation comes.
State regulators are also in charge of determining who pays for what. Who's going to pay for all of this, and how much money are we talking about?
Well, this is a process that is actually being decided and looked at and investigated by the California Public Utilities Commission. And the CEO of Edison International, the parent company of the company that operates the plant, put some numbers on it. He said that up until now, it's cost about $1.3 billion since January to operate the plant and find replacement power. He also said that investors already have sunk about $2.1 billion into the plant, so it's an asset worth $2.1 billion. So the question for ratepayers is, will they be on the hook for this $1.3 billion? Some people even question whether ratepayers should pay the $700 million for the new steam generators that turned out to be faulty, which, when you add it all together, means that there's like $2 billion hanging in the balance, and the CPUC will have to decide in coming months whether ratepayers will be on the hook or whether they'll get a refund.
Well, Allison, thank you for explaining it to us.
My pleasure.
Allison St. John is a reporter for KPBS in San Diego. This week, the Senate takes up an immigration reform bill as the House struggles to write its own version. The last time Congress passed a comprehensive immigration bill, Ronald Reagan was in the White House. Nearly 3 million immigrants gained a path to citizenship then. 26 years ago, KPCC's Washington correspondent Kitty Feldy followed one young couple as they anxiously made their way through the process. So how did amnesty change their lives?
Okay, so we've got 1981 covered, 1982.
The story of Oscar and Martha Mendoza began with a mountain of paper 3 inches high. Rent receipts, pay stubs, tax returns, even uncashed checks for coins lost in that ancient technology known as a payphone.
I got a big box, and every time when I receive papers, put it in the box.
Oscar Mendoza came to the U.S. in 1979 in the trunk of a car. He was 19 and fled El Salvador after his uncle was killed in the Civil War. Oscar met Martha on a bus near L.A. She was also undocumented, an immigrant from Mexico. They married and worked jobs at an auto detail shop and a balloon factory. And they had two American-born children, 5-year-old Tony and 2-year-old Kelly. Oscar had heard rumors of a new law that promised legal status. He knew he'd need proof that he'd lived and worked in the U.S. for a number of years. That new law, IRCA, the Immigration Reform and Control Act, was signed by President Ronald Reagan in 1986. Oscar showed me the precious box of papers that he hoped would become their ticket to legalization.
You know, it's my life, you know.
Oscar began to cry. His attorney had to continue.
For him, you know, this is going to be the only way he has of remaining in this country. He has a great deal at stake here. He has children who were born here. The country means a lot to him. He's established himself here. He has a new life. He can't afford to forfeit it.
Okay, this is my ID, my driver's license.
The process of legalization wasn't fast, and it wasn't easy. Martha Mendoza says it was also expensive.
$1,087, exactly.
There were doctor's examinations, interviews with immigration officials, a civics exam, and the dreaded English test. Looking back, the Mendoza son, Tony, remembers playing in the back of a crowded classroom with the other kids as his folks tried to learn a new language.
I vividly remember my mom and dad's Spanish to English dictionary that they used to carry everywhere with them, and I remember the late night ESL classes.
Tony is 31 now, living outside Washington, D.C., supervising construction projects for the U.S. Navy.
I remember when my mom failed the exam. I remember her crying.
Tony also remembers a constant nagging worry about what was going to happen to the family. What did happen was a surprise. Once the Mendozas got legitimate Social Security numbers, checks started rolling in. They'd paid taxes over the years, but with phony numbers, the refunds they deserved were never sent. Enough money rolled in for the family to move out of their one-bedroom apartment in Pomona. You can still hear the pride Martha Mendoza felt a quarter century ago as she showed off her new tract house in Colton.
Everything is new. For me, my house and my kitchen looks like if it were rich people.
For Oscar, the house was proof he belonged.
Now everybody told me, said, this is American dream for everybody. You know, your house, your job, your car, your family, your dog, and your birds. I made it.
In the late 1990s, Oscar and Martha finally qualified to become American citizens and registered to vote. Tony says his folks wouldn't say, but...
I think my mom is a Republican, and my dad, my dad switches. You know, I think most recently he voted Democrat.
It's been a few years since I spoke with Oscar and Martha, so I picked up the phone. Oscar, it's Kitty Feldy.
Kitty, how you doing?
Oscar tells me the family moved out of California to keep Tony away from gang trouble in the schools. They had another son, Dakota, who today serves as a U.S. Marine. The couple started their own business, making dentures and dental implants. Today they're living outside of Phoenix and even buying a vacation home in Mexico. Oscar says becoming an American changed his life.
I never going to have another opportunity like this in my life. Even if I'm moving in Europe or moving to someplace else, I think I never going to have this opportunity to growing and working and get what I want when I work. You can get anything you want if you work in this country.
Son Tony says when his folks took that oath of citizenship, it gave them something more than financial security. He says he thinks he understands that feeling. Tony is gay, and just last year, surrounded by his parents and his two siblings, he and his partner got married.
Once I had that license, once my husband and I were legally recognized as a couple, you know, I had a confidence that, you know, that nothing was going to break us. And I think mom and dad, you know, that was their thing too. Once they had amnesty, they had that confidence that nothing was going to, you know, stop them from achieving what they wanted, you know, achieving all their dreams.
Congress now begins the debate about whether another 11 million undocumented immigrants will be given a path to citizenship, a chance to achieve their own American dreams. For the California Report, I'm Kitty Feldy in Washington, D.C.
Take a close look at a cocktail menu these days, and you're likely to spot a lot of local artisanal producers making everything from herbaceous gins to fruity liqueurs. Californians and tourists alike naturally want to visit the places where the liquor is made, take a tour, and try a tasting, as they do in many places around the world. But state law isn't set up to allow distilleries to meet the demand. Megan McCarty reports a number of them are banding together to change the rules.
The ground floor of the distillery.
Welcome to Green Bar Collective, the first distillery to open up shop in Los Angeles since Prohibition.
You see, we're filling that fermenter with molasses for our rum.
In an old warehouse on the outskirts of downtown, owner Melkin Kozrovian oversees the production of a range of handcrafted spirits, all made from locally sourced organic ingredients.
Our lemon vodka, like many of the spirits here, is painfully handmade. We buy lemons from local farms. Right now we're pulling lemons from Malibu. We wash them, and then we hand zest 2,000 whole lemons.
So, could I taste it? Well, technically, I could try it for free. And while I wouldn't mind that too much, it's not the greatest business move for Kozrovian. Unlike wineries and breweries in California, distilleries are not allowed to offer paid tastings or sell bottles of their products on site. We're part of a tiny minority of four states to have such laws on the books. Now, a group of about 30 distilleries has banded together to try to change that law. AB 933 is now in committee in the state Senate and awaiting a full vote by the state assembly.
Assembly Bill 933 is absolutely vital to the growth and success of all the small distilleries in California.
That's Lance Winters, the head distiller at St. George Spirits in Alameda. They've been in business since 1982, long enough to find some creative ways around the restrictions.
Currently, what we do when people come in for a tour and tasting, we can charge for a tour. But as you can imagine, there are a lot of people that would be coming in who they don't have time for a tour. There's no way that we can compel them to pay for a tour without taking one.
Winter says they're currently operating their tastings at a loss, but he hopes if the legislation passes, they'll have enough revenue to staff a full-time tasting room. And there are certainly receptive customers, like Esther Gailridge, who stopped into St. George to sample their Chipotle vodka.
Well, what's great about it is you have a chance to taste and see what it's made out of. And our tour guide was fantastic. He showed us everything, answered all our questions.
One question that hasn't been answered is whether the proposed bill would allow customers like Gailridge to buy bottles of liquor directly from the distillery. Currently, if she wanted to purchase a bottle of her favorite vodka, it would have to go from St. George to a distributor to a retailer before she could get her hands on it. Gailridge says she finds the laws ridiculous.
Well, to me, they're ancient and inadequate. If I like something, I want to be able to purchase it on the grounds that that I discovered it.
If you think of a winery that operates a tasting room and couldn't sell their wine directly to consumers, it would be a bit of a tease if you ask me.
Arthur Hartunian is the president of the California Artisanal Distillers Guild and helped put together AB 933. He says they're still pushing for an amendment that would allow for bottle sales, but they're coming up against some stiff resistance. Much of it is from liquor distributors like Manuel Espinoza.
Our concern is it creates a new liquor store where the line between a distiller and a retailer is obliterated.
Liquor wholesalers have considerable influence to back them up. Over the last 4 years, their lobby has contributed almost $600,000 to Sacramento lawmakers. But Hartunian stresses the distributors have nothing to fear from craft distillers.
We want distributors. We need distributors. I certainly don't expect anybody to back up a truck and buy a pallet of vodka from my facilities. We are not liquor stores. We are artisans.
Hartunian's lobbyist will continue to work with the distributors to try to craft a bill that everyone can agree to before the full vote in the assembly. Meanwhile, back at Green Bar Distillery in L.A., Melkin Kizrovian is hopeful things will go his way. He shows me around a swanky new tasting room he's already built at the location.
On one side, there's a 14-person bar, fully equipped to handle currently a non-existent crowd, but one day, hopefully, some visitors. We have built it if only they would come.
I guess that is seeing the glass half full. For the California Report, I'm Megan McCarty.
Fitting into a rigid system has always been hard for Calder Katz, a senior at Venice High School. And unlike most of his classmates, he's not going straight to college. Today, our Graduation Day series continues with the story of how Katz found a different direction on the farm. Helena Liikkanen-Renge reports.
These purplish lettuces, those chards, red chards, that's a patch of carrots. We planted those not too long ago. Then you have wavy lettuce over here. We have a lot of this.
Calder Katz winds his way through Venice High School's learning garden. He kneels down and plants potatoes in the earth. The daily landscaping class is his favorite.
Farming, that's almost like being a parent, you know? You plant these seeds and you nurture them and you make them become as good as possible. You make them the best that they can be.
For Calder, actually enjoying a subject in school hasn't come easy. And he's never really wanted to fit in.
I've always thought that being weird was really cool. When somebody's different, that is so refreshing. You know, get away from the common rabble of everybody else and go into your own little world.
But in school, Calder is expected to complete assignments like everybody else, which for him is sometimes hard to understand.
I really think that the whole school system is sort of a fitting a person into a box situation. You know, like writing an essay. That's such a standardized thing at this point. It's five paragraphs, you know, you have to have the introduction, the core paragraphs, and then the conclusion. Maybe you don't want to write it that way. Maybe we want to start out the intro somewhere else. You know, like start it out like a movie where it starts with the end or something. You know, that doesn't fly with schools.
Calder hit bottom 5 years ago when he failed seventh grade.
At that point, I would have probably thought, I'm going to just go downhill from here. You know, I repeated seventh grade. That's terrible. What student does that? That's a real hard thing to live through the next year because everybody else knows. Because everybody knows each other there. So you get kind of picked on for that kind of stuff. It's kind of a shameful thing.
We're all like rejects from the school system.
Yeah. Calder's father, Alan Katz, is an artist and understands his son's problems with school.
We tend to learn our own ways, you know, and that school puts you in a rigid, you know, regimentation which is geared towards creating a product more than a human being.
Calder's family is preparing dinner from the vegetables he's brought from his school's garden. Calder's home is like a fairy tale house on a suburban street with its handmade furniture and mosaic detailing.
Well, we did give them a lot of freedom to be themselves.
Oh, come on, you're completely different than most parents.
Yeah, and, well, how would you say we're different?
Because, look at your house. You completely changed the place that you're living.
That's because we're artists, you know,
exactly.
And most people
well,
think
I mean,
about those things.
Where you are brought up in really changes how you, what you become, you know?
Calder, go forage. Guys, this is your chance to rob the garden, eat the broccoli, for crying out loud.
That's Diane Pollock, Calder's landscape and horticulture teacher.
They need to explore and they need to find the joy of what the earth is like so they can go out and work with it and find out what is important to save their own environment.
I would have never expected that I would be actually the top of the class. People come to me to find out more about gardening. That's so strange to me. I've never had that sort of aura to me.
Gardening has given Calder so much that after he graduates in June, he's heading overseas to do some farming.
After graduation, I'm going to Sweden for 3 months to work on an organic farm by myself, focusing on wanting to learn more from the world and learn more from other people, not necessarily teachers. I feel like that would benefit me more than just immediately going into college.
Calder says when he comes back, he won't be the same person he was when he left. For the California Report, I'm Helena Liikanen-Renger in Los Angeles.
That story was produced in collaboration with the USC Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism. Next week, our Graduation Day series continues with a profile of a young contender who hopes boxing will prove his ticket out of poverty. Online comments get a bad rap. True, unhinged vitriol is rampant on some websites, but there are also beautiful, moving, and funny comments. A play opening at the Hollywood Fringe Festival this weekend pulls from the entire gamut to show how comments can build community. Alex Schmidt reports.
Spend much time online? Then you probably have an opinion about the state of comments. I asked some folks around LA. Here's what they said.
I think online comments are pretty useless.
Embellished.
The worst elements of people's personal natures are coming out.
Divisive.
Careless. Yep, it's a pretty common perception that the state of online conversation is dreadful. But imagine if you could watch those conversations on stage as a play.
L.A., you are making the common mistake that people are using downtown L.A. as the marker to which areas are named. No. Echo Park is not east of downtown L.A.
A new play called Unmoderated had its first informal staging at a Los Angeles restaurant in March. The material for the play comes from the raw, lively comment section of a local blog called The East Sider.
I divided all of the stories into
dramatic and comedic. So trying to get like a balance between like funny and dramatic.
That's director Rory Mitchell. He sifted through thousands of comments and picked a simple staging for them. In a brick-walled room, the audience sits at tables below a short stage. The actors stand before them in a straight line. The focus is all on the words.
Art scene? Where? I know, right? Name one important gallery in Silver Lake and I will shoot a hole in my left arm.
Just made it more human, obviously.
That's Jesus Sanchez, publisher of the Eastsider blog. He's been running the Eastsider for 4 years, and this play was the first time he had ever heard the comments read out loud. He said it felt strange, but also totally appropriate, given that his community is full of life, even if it is virtual.
It's sort of an acknowledgement of where stories are taking place these days and where they're being retold. It's not around a campfire or, you know, at a poetry reading. It's actually taking place online.
Before Sanchez started the Eastsider blog, he worked for the LA Times. Back then, the only comments he cared about were his editors. Now, as a self-employed publisher, Sanchez's commenters are his editors. They correct his mistakes. And they provide emotion that he, as an impartial reporter, isn't able to. Take this dramatic section of the play.
My brother, may he R.I.P. love you with all my heart.
Those comments were left on the Eastsider after a young Echo Park resident named Ivan Pedroza was shot and killed in the neighborhood.
Hope that coward that did this gets his. You will never be forgotten.
Ivan and I have a son together, which just turned 4 a week ago. He has a newborn baby girl and a 2-year-old boy. I miss you, Ivan.
This type of space can be valuable for a community. But of course, not all comment spaces operate this way, says Kirsten Thorson. She's a professor of communications at USC.
If you go to a place like YouTube, where people don't normally engage in conversations, right? So there's no opportunity for sort of politeness norms to emerge or sort of kind ways to talk to each other to emerge.
In the grand scheme, we're still in the early days of figuring out how to create the best, most dynamic online communities. That's exactly why the time is right for a play about the topic, says director Rory Mitchell.
We don't understand what the internet is yet and what it's doing to us and how it's changing the way we interact with each other. And theater is the place that human beings have always taken all of the things that we've struggled with in real life, and we kind of put it in this box and we try and figure out and see what makes it tick and how it all works.
For all the folks I talked to who said online comments are obnoxious, there were some notable exceptions.
I guess they're necessary.
Mixed blessing.
It's what people think, but they're too afraid to say. And there's a lot of courage from behind a keyboard.
You can refine your view of online comments when Unmoderated has its formal debut at the Hollywood Fringe Festival. For the California Report, I'm Alex Schmidt.
And that's The California Report, a production of KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. Our director is Susie Racho. The technical producer is Seal Muller. We had additional engineering from Howard Gelman and Rob Spate. The online team includes Lisa Pickoff-White, David Marks, and Don Clyde. Our interns are Rachel Marcus and Carly Nairn. Tyke Hendricks was a contributing editor. Our editorial team includes Victoria Mauleon, Ingrid Becker, Bruce Kuhn, and Raul Ramirez. I'm Rachel Miro. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995. The California Teachers Association, celebrating 150 years of advocating for all students, educators, and California's public schools and colleges. And the California Endowment, Health Happens in Neighborhoods, at calendow.org.